This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The American freeway is both a blessing and a curse. It enables speedy travel across cities and states, but it also divides communities physically and economically. It pollutes and decimates surrounding neighborhoods and provokes major political battles. Often, communities of color have been on the negative end of the impacts of freeway construction. Freeways are associated with urban sprawl and a loss of community. Historic homes are bulldozed or have their values plummet in service to the freeway. But freeways are also unexpected canvases for art and political expression. My guest, Eric Avila, is a professor of history and Chicano studies and urban planning at UCLA. He wrote the book Popular Culture in the Age of White Flight, Fear and Fantasy in Suburban Los Angeles. His latest book is called The Folklore of the Freeway, Race and Revolt in the Modernist City. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Eric.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the origins of America's love affair with the freeway, the Interstate Highway Act of 1956. This launched this great wave of freeway building across the nation. What prompted it? And of course, this was during the time of the Cold War. So the cultural context certainly must have been significant when this act was passed and when the freeways were being built.
Absolutely. The original title of the Interstate Highway Act was the National Interstate Highway and Defense Act, which emphasized the defensive needs of the nation to build a national highway infrastructure that connected cities across the nation. This was the 1950s. Mass suburbanization was taking shape. Americans were enjoying unprecedented levels of prosperity. They were buying automobiles. So the nation needed this infrastructure to connect the nation through this transportation network.
And this played very much into this notion that the automobile would be the sort of center of American existence.
Absolutely. The 1950s marked the heyday of the automobile. It marked the high point of the nation's love affair with the automobile. It was an age of optimism around the automobile and its ability to move people quickly, efficiently, and probably most importantly, privately, unlike subways and trains. This was a private mode of transportation that represented the kind of summit of the American dream in the 1950s.
And individualism, et cetera. Right?
Absolutely.
Right. You write in your book about the men who were part of the drive to build the freeways, the men who led this vision, of course, all men, all white men. What was the sort of intellectual power and mystique that they wielded and the sense of objective achievement that they were leading?
Well, I think you have to remember that the 1950s was a moment in American culture when experts were revered for their know-how, their technological command. And Americans put a lot of faith in experts, whether they were medical experts or military experts or engineering experts. And the men, predominantly white men, who built the freeways were part of that culture of expertise in the 1950s.
And so they were trusted by most Americans. But then what they found as freeways began to be built around the nation was that not everybody was happy about their community having a gigantic concrete structure tear right through it. Let's talk about San Francisco, where people who lived there revolted at the idea of the Embarcadero Freeway. What were they driven by?
San Francisco is an interesting example because I think it was the first moment when highway engineers discovered that not everybody welcomed their expertise. And in San Francisco, some of the city's most powerful, most affluent communities banded together and said, no, we don't want this freeway coming through our neighborhood. And so they organized a very powerful association of like community alliances to stop official federal plans for highway construction in San Francisco. So as early as 1954, 1955, highway engineers discovered that they could not build seven freeways through the city of San Francisco. And in fact, they only got to build 1.5 freeways because of the powerful influence of community associations in that city.
So this launched a series of what you call freeway revolts around the country, including in Beverly Hills, but also in places like Boston. And what surprised me in your book was your finding that several of these revolts are today interpreted as diverse communities coming together to defeat powerful interests, a sort of racial unity. But in fact, many of the actual struggles against the freeways were led by white elites.
For the most part, yes, that's what I found in my research. These communities fought freeways in cities in the 1960s. And in the 60s, they adopted this discourse of multiracial, interclass unity. And that was becoming a dominant discourse in the 1960s, emphasizing diversity and togetherness. But in the context of actually fighting freeways, whether it was Beverly Hills or Boston, I found that people used the discourse to justify their fight against the freeway. But in fact, the communities that won their fight against the freeway, like Beverly Hills, like Princeton, like Cambridge, Massachusetts, in reality were more or less white, affluent, middle class or upper middle class communities that didn't reflect the diversity that they embraced.
So how did freeway planners use what you call the geography of race in determining where to build freeways? If white communities successfully fought back, then did freeway planners simply opt for poor and communities of color to build these in?
Yeah, for the most part, poor working class communities of color in cities were designated as the paths of least resistance. These were communities that did not have the wherewithal, did not have the resources to stand up and fight against the freeway. There were too many other things to fight at the time.
Right.
But highway engineers in the 1950s and 60s were part of a broader culture that looked upon racial communities as blight and in the way of progress.
And that word blight, you say, sort of became this coded word that actually was used to document how certain communities were seen.
Yes, that's an important part of American urban history going back to the 1920s and 30s when the federal government actively mapped racial communities in order to figure out where to build invasive infrastructural projects like urban planning projects or highway projects. These communities were often targeted, not explicitly targeted, but implicitly targeted for their racial character.
Let's talk about gender. So there's race, but then there's also gender. You have a whole chapter in your book about feminism and the freeways, which I had really no idea about. The freeways of the country were being built at around the same time as second wave feminism was coming up. How did feminists respond to the freeway and what did it symbolize to them?
Well, I wouldn't say that feminists actually responded to the freeway per se, but my point in that chapter is to document how women played an important and visible role in fighting freeways in many cities, as mothers, as community organizers, or just simply as, you know, tough organizers. And the visibility of women in the fight against the freeway coincided with second wave feminism in the United States. And for many women, and this is what I argue in the chapter, highway construction symbolized a threat to families, schools, parks, and other institutions of community stability.
Right, because when freeways were built, of course, one thing that happened is the communities just got spread apart more. And you point out in your book that it represented a subsequent suburbanization that further relegated women to be sort of confined in their home to the drudgery of household work.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one aspect of the history of suburbanization is that it had negative consequences for women. I mean, in the early 60s, Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, which was largely an indictment of suburbanization for the way that it consigned women to the private sphere, to the, as you say, the drudgery of housework and the privacy, the isolation of the suburban home.
So the other aspect of freeways, which is also surprising to me, is art. Art about the freeways and art on the freeways. Mm-hmm. So you have a section in your book with color plates of all the art that's been inspired by freeways. First, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of my main arguments in the book is that urban communities of color, because they had very limited resources to take on freeway builders, they had to find alternative means to express their protest or their grievances against highway construction. And for many working class urban communities of color, art and other forms of cultural expression become vital and necessary forms of political expression. Scholars often tend to divide the political from the cultural. But in the history of building freeways in cities, art became a necessary political response to the destruction that highways inflicted upon urban communities of color. So a lot of the art in the book, I argue, reflects a racial critique of what freeways did to cities during the 1950s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. And then there's art on the freeways, one of the best examples of which you also have photos of this in your book is Chicano Park in San Diego. But we also have Judy Baca's work in Los Angeles on the freeways.
Right. Yeah. Baca is an important example of how people from these communities strive to transform the freeway and its presence in their neighborhoods into a community asset by using it as a canvas upon which to express their own particular sense of identity, community, and history. So Chicano Park is another example where these amazing murals are painted on the columns and surfaces of a highway interchange in the heart of San Diego's Mexican-American barrio, which in that sense, they are able to transform the meaning of the freeway to make it relevant to their sense of community, history, and identity.
One of the stories that you tell throughout your book that I think is perhaps one of the most extreme examples of freeway fights is Hawaii's H3 freeway, which became, I believe, one of the most, if not the most expensive freeway construction project in U.S. history, and it caused major political turmoil on the ground. Tell us that story and why it's important.
It's a very interesting story. H3 was a highway designed in the early 1960s, designed to connect Honolulu with a military base on the other side of the island. And initially, people in Hawaii protested the freeway on environmentalist grounds. But as the fight continued, the tone of the debate shifted later in the 1970s and 1980s, and indigenous groups in Hawaii with a strong sense of connection to Hawaii's indigenous past began to organize in protest against the freeway because of its destruction of sacred indigenous grounds. And what I find interesting about the story of H3 is the kind of unexpected consequences of building a freeway and how it spurred or provoked this kind of racial response among people who had a connection to Hawaii's indigenous past. Mm.
And so sort of ultimately, when you've had this history throughout the United States of the freeway causing turmoil, many freeways being disrupted, several freeways ending in unexpected dead ends, but whole neighborhoods, especially black neighborhoods, wiped out, as you point out, in cities like Detroit and New Orleans. Ultimately, what sort of outcome or pattern of outcomes have you seen by communities of color, you know, in addition to treating them as canvases, where they've come to figure out ways to live with the freeway?
Well, I think that's been an ongoing struggle. I don't think there's one clear answer as how to live with a freeway. But in my book, I try to document the many, many attempts to reconcile the presence, the unwanted presence of a freeway in urban communities of color through art, through historic commemoration, and many, many other forms that I call the folklore of the freeway. And I think it's important that we recognize these efforts because they're kind of invisible to us.
Right. And finally, how has the attitude of engineers, today's freeway men, changed, having seen this history unfold and these struggles continually erupt? Have they changed and understood that this objective approach to building freeways as simply efficient ways to get from one place to the other really needs to have a cultural context.
Yeah, we don't live in the 1950s anymore. We don't celebrate the automobile and the freeway like we used to in the 1950s. And today, the official culture of planning has changed in significant ways to emphasize the community context in which freeways are built. But one of the big arguments of my book is that that lesson comes from urban communities of color that insisted upon cultural context, community context, going all the way back to the 1960s. So, you know, long before planners discovered context, activists in Black communities and Chicano communities were insisting upon cultural context and inventing their own creative ways to assert that context. And today, you can't build a freeway without going through layers upon layers of bureaucracy. And that bureaucracy is there to make sure that the mistakes of the past have not been repeated.
Eric Avila, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guest, Eric Avila, is an associate professor of history and Chicano studies and urban planning at the University of California in Los Angeles. His book is called The Folklore of the Freeway, Race and Revolt in the Modernist City. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break.